Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's Ohel Miriam conference entitled Help, My Son is Growing Up, What Should I Say? My name is Yehoshua Berman. I am an author slash educator slash speaker who lives in Ramat Beit Shemesh with my wife and children, Baruch Hashem, and it is my honor and zchus that Ohel Miriam has asked me to give a conference on this topic and the course that will, Emir Tashem, follow in the coming weeks. We've just begun the six-week Tkufa of Shavivim, so it is the perfect time to be addressing the inyonim that are negeya to boys growing up. Before I launch into the actual topic of the conference, there are two hakdomais, two introductions that I feel are important to lay down before we actually dive into the material itself. Hakdoma number one is about the choice of language that I will be using for this conference, and in particular, during the course that will Emir Tashem follow. I plan to often use forthright English terminology for things that we generally are makpid to only say in the Lashon HaKodesh and euphemistic expressions. The truth is that this little hakdama also carries within it one of the asidus of the entire conference slash course that Emir Tashem will follow. So here are the reasons why I've chosen to often use completely straightforward English language. There's a Gemara in Maseches Pesachim, Daf Gimel Amud Beis, and that is where we find the sugya of what's called Lashon Nekiya. Lashon Nekiya means to speak in as refined a manner as possible. Now the Gemara over there makes it very clear Lashon Nekiya is very, very important. However, as the Gemara is explained by Rashi, there is one very important stipulation, one very important qualification. And that is that the general rule is that if it is going to take you longer to say something in Lashon Nekiya, in refined language, then it's better to choose a shorter way to say it, even if that means that you're going to have to use Lashon Megune, something that would otherwise be considered relatively more crass. La'olam yishaneh adam l'talmidav b'derech kitzara. To take the brief way of saying something, to say it in a more terse, more kurz and scharf, quick and to the point, that is the most important thing. That's the most important consideration. So that's number one. Number two, there is a Gemara in Maseches Shabbos, Daf Lamed Gimel Amud Beis, Daf Lamed Gimel Amud Aleph, and the same Gemara comes up in Ksubis, Daf Ches Amud Beis, and the Gemara says a very fascinating statement. Hakol Yoidin Kala Lamedich Nesalachopo. Everybody knows why a kala goes into the chuppah. Now, mind you, when Chazal were talking about the chuppah, they didn't mean, like nowadays, what we call the chuppah, which is the canopy. They meant the cheder yichud. They meant being together alone with the chassan in the room that's going to serve as their bedroom for the at least for the duration of the Sheva Brachas. So the Gemara says, Everybody knows kala lama nichnas alachopa. Everybody knows what they are going to be doing inside their private room. But if someone dirties his mouth and he expresses dirty words from his mouth, even if he already had a signed, sealed, and delivered, so to speak, Gezerah, decree from Shemayim that he's going to have 70 years of everything Givaldic, it's going to turn on him for the bad. Now, it's interesting. Someone that I know once confided to me that the chasen shmuz that he got from his mashgiach in yeshiva was all of about a few seconds. It literally took less than 1 minute. What did his mashgiach tell him? His mashgiach told him the following: make with one hand a fist, but don't close it all the way. Leave it ever so slightly open, enough room that you can take the finger of your other hand, insert it into your almost closed fist, and now, put it in and out, but in a way that it's like it's a little bit difficult for it to go in and out and in and out. And after he did that for a few seconds, his mashgiach said to him, "It's uncomfortable, right?" He said, "Yes." Said, "Good, now you learned to always use lubrication." That was it. Now, luckily for this particular individual, his father was a bit more intelligent than his mashgiach, at least regarding the matter of premarital guidance for a chassan, and he gave his son a book that contains much more comprehensive information on the topic. But let's ask a question. If a chassan Chazan Rebbe wants to do, let's say, better than that particular Mashgiach. He wants to actually be helpful to his Talmidim, to his Chassanim, and he takes the time and the effort to explain everything about marital intimacy in a clear, forthright manner. Is that Chazan Rebbe violating the Isser of Nibble Peh that the Gemara is talking about? Obviously not. Obviously that is not what the Gemara is talking about. Now I'd like to tell you another Maiso, and this one was, I was the party to the Maiso. This was when I was in 10th grade in the Yeshiva High School of Greater Washington. At that point in my life, I had a what you might call a funny lunch break habit. And that was that I would sit in on the Bekiyas Shir, the Gemara Bekiyas Shir, that was for the 11th graders. It was not for the 10th graders. I was in 10th grade. And this Bekiyas Shir was for the 11th graders. But I had this funny habit that during my lunch break, I decided to just go into the room. Nobody told me not to, so I enjoyed it. Now, the Magid Shir was one of my Rebbeim in Yeshiva High School. His name was Rabbi David Hayit, Zichron Tzadik Livracha. And he was the Rebbe of that particular class. And at that kufle, he was teaching the boys Maseches Makis. So one day we're holding on Dav Zayin Amud Aleph, and over there we have the Mishnah and the Gemara that discusses how Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Tarfon said that if we would have been on the Beis Din, you know, if it would have been up to us, we would have always found a way of getting out of giving people Chiyuv Misa. We never would have imposed the Beis Din death penalty on sinners. So the Gemara says, how would they do that? You know, someone, two Eidim come in the time that there's a Sanhedrin, and they say, look, we saw this Yid b'Michal Shabbos, we gave him a Hasra, we warned him, don't do that, if you do that, the Bezin is going to kill you. Like, what would they do? So one of the examples that the Gemara gives is, let's say two Eidim, two witnesses would come in, and they would say, look, we saw Reuven, and we saw Reuven and Rachel, we saw them doing niuf, we saw them committing adultery, Rachel is married to some other man. We warned them, and they said, yeah, we know that the Bezin is going to kill us, and we're doing it anyway. So what would they do? How could Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Tarfon not impose the death penalty? Remember, they're talking about if they would have been on the Sanhedrin. So the Gemara says that in that type of a case, Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Tarfon would have said, tell me, witnesses, did you see k'mikchol b'shvayferis? Now, mikchol is a eye makeup applicator. So it's like some type of a stick of some sort. And the shvayferes is the makeup tube. It's the tube that holds the makeup. So that is a euphemistic way. The literal translation is, did you see the applicator going into the tube? Now, when Rabbi Hayat Zatzal was explaining this, he said something to the following effect. He said, according to Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Tarfon, if the Eidim did not see exactly what is going on by the Oisei Mokoim, then the adulterers cannot be put to death. At which I, the 10th grade, so to speak, interloper into this year, I blurted out, Rabbi, what does Oso Mokoim mean? Now, I genuinely had no idea what it meant, and I just wanted to understand what he was saying. I had no clue what the term Oisei Mokoim meant. And Rabbi Hayek looked up at me, and without batting an eyelash, he said, vagina. The room was silent. Now, Rabbi Hayek was a good Rebbe, and he was also quite the disciplinarian type. So, you know, it's the type of Rebbe that you don't try to mess with. And the shir anyway was a shir of very good boys, so more or less the room was always quiet during the shir. But at that moment, I felt the silence grow very thick and very heavy. And I felt like I wanted the ground to push it, swallow me up. Here I was, an outsider who didn't even belong there, and look at the mess I had made. I immediately said, oh, sorry. I cannot describe to you how mortified I felt over asking that question. But once again, Rabbi Hayat did not miss a beat. And this time, in a much louder voice and with great emphasis, he says, why are you sorry? Why are you sorry? Don't be sorry. It's Torah. If you don't understand something, then of course you ask. In Torah, there is no such thing as not asking or not answering because you don't want to say something delicate or so-called inappropriate. If it's to understand Torah, then there is nothing more appropriate. So it's pashut. It's pashut that what the Gemara in Pesachim means when it's talking about nibble peh, it's that when someone is talking about intimate matters and there's no purpose, there's no justification, there's no reason, and it's what we would call in English gratuitous. It's totally unnecessary. And it's just dirty talk to indulge what the Ramchal calls znus hapeh v'ha'izen, the licentiousness of the mouth or the ear. Then that is aser. That's nibble peh, that's taka, a serious iser, as we see from the Gemara. But if there's a legitimate need, then not only is it okay, but it's necessary and a mitzvah. As Rabbi Hyatt put it, it's Torah. Accordingly, in the context of this conference, and as I said, Mirtz Hashem, the course that will follow in the coming weeks of Mirtz Hashem, there are two justifications for the use of clear-cut, unambiguous language. Number one, it is very important that everyone understand exactly what we are talking about, especially when it comes to very sensitive topics that are so crucial for a person's development, for a person's emotional health, and the entire sense of balance and equilibrium as a person and as a yid. It is crucial to make sure that nothing is misunderstood. Everything has to be crystal clear. That's number one. Number two is that a huge part of what we're doing here is to try to dispel and get rid of the pervading sense of stigma and taboo that is so often associated with this subject. We are coming to both learn and eventually teach to our kinderlach, to our children, to our boys, that there is nothing in life that the Torah does not address. Every single aspect of life is governed by the Torah, and we therefore can and must address even the most sensitive, intimate aspects of life and learn and teach what it is that the Torah tells us about them. So if I were to use cagey, euphemistic language, it would likely just reinforce the sense of stigma and taboo that we are trying to overcome. Now, as a derech agav, but the truth is that it really isn't derech agav. What we see from all of this is that the use of Lashon Nekiyah, speaking in a refined manner, is not meant to be some sort of avoidance tactic, like someone who never suffers from OCD and always opens doors with his feet because he cannot bear the thought of touching doorknobs because he fears that they are contaminated with harmful germs. Lashon Nekiyah is not an avoidance tactic. It's not the pshat that we're supposed to be afraid of saying it in the plain English. It's not the pshat that we just can't bring ourselves to say it like it is, so we use distancing euphemisms. No, that is not the pshat in Lashon Nekiyah. Rather, what is the pshat? Lashon Nekiyah is a maila in adinus hanefesh. It's a very heightened sense of refinement. It's not fear. Yes, we can say things in a clear-cut, straightforward manner, but wherever possible, we choose to use Lashon Nekiyah, because it's a maila of refinement. So that's the nekuda. We're not supposed to be afraid of being able to say it like it is. And when it's necessary to say it like it is, then you do say it like it is. And in Mirtz Hashem, that is what we will be doing. So that is Hakdamah number one, legabe, the use of, oftentimes, the use of clear-cut, unambiguous English expressions. Hakdamah number two. The subject matter of this conference, and Emir Tashem, the course that will follow in the coming weeks, is often referred to as Inyani Kedusha, or Kedusha Sabris, or Pigama Bris, on the flip side, on the Tzadara. So there's a few points that I want to make, and one of them is the Iker point. Number one, it's just to put things into perspective, into context, into proportion, it's worthwhile noting that to the best of my knowledge, these expressions referring to the mitzvahs and averis that pertain to sexuality as in Yoni Kedusha or Kedusha Sabris or Pagamak Bris, to the best of my knowledge, these are rather recent expressions in the overall sweep of Jewish history that we don't find in Chazal or Rishonim, or at least definitely not often. But much more importantly, we need to ask, what do we mean by in Yoni Kedusha? What do we mean when we say that? Now, whenever there's something that has the word Kedusha attached to it, it seems that a lot of people relate to things of that nature in a mystical or perhaps even quasi-superstitious way. Basically, what seems to be going on in some people's minds is something like this. I really have no idea what is so important about these things. But apparently there is some gewaltige ruchnizike koyach here going on. And it even sounds a bit scary, or maybe even more than a bit scary. So like, whoa, these are big, heavy things, and I better keep in line, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So really, if we're really going to ask this question, what we really need to ask is a much more basic question. What is Kedusha? What is Kedusha? We use this word throughout Yiddishkeit. What does the word mean? Can we define for ourselves in our spoken English? Now, I'm sure that there could be a number of ways of answering this question, what is Kedusha? How do you define Kedusha? And what I'm going to put forth now are my thoughts on the matter, which I believe bring out one of the most fundamental points of Yiddishkeit. There is a medrash in Eicha Rabba. If you'd like to look it up, it's Perek Beis, Piska Yud Gimel. But you probably don't need to look it up because it's probably one of the most famous midrashim. And the medrash says, if someone would come to tell you, Chachma b'umais, that the goyim have chachma. There's chachma by the goyim. There's wisdom by the goyim. Tamin. Believe him. But if someone tells you, Torah b'umais, you know, even by the goyim, there's also Torah. Also by the goyim, there's Torah. Al tamin. Do not believe him. Now, of course, that makes perfect sense to us, right? I mean, after all, the Torah is our special bris with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's the chem de genuzo that the malachi malo said Be'etzim should have no place. Ma enosh kisiz karenu, says the Gemara. The Malachim are saying, Ribbono Shel Olam, what are you doing giving the Torah to Basar V'dam? To people of flesh and blood? Why are you taking this Heilige Torah that belongs in the Elyonim and you're putting it into the Tachtonim? You're giving it to flesh and blood in the physical realm. And Lamaisa HaKadosh Baruch Hu did give it, but he only gave it to the people that are his Mamleches Kehanim, the Goy Kadosh. These special, special, special people. So yeah, it makes perfect sense to us. If someone were to say, you know, there's Torah Eichid by the Goyim. Also by the Goyim, there's Torah that, of course, we should not believe him. But can we ask a question? Where does Chachma come from? The Medrash is contrasting Chachma and Torah. Now, let's think about this for a moment. All of the amazing mathematical equations and numbers and formulas and mathematical structures that govern all the laws of the universe. Things that if you ever take, you know, the time to read something written by these quantum physicists, okay, it's almost like Chinese when trying to read it, but one thing you get is that the math behind the universe is astounding. Now, all of the incredible engineering, from cockroaches to dolphins to silently soaring snow owls, it's all the chachma of Mi She'amar V'Hayo Ha'olam, isn't it? So anything which can genuinely be identified as chachma, it's not something that people made up. It's something that people discovered. They looked at the world, istakel ba'almo, they looked at the world, and they, I mean, if they would have half a brain in their heads, they would talk and say what we say. Marabu ma'secha Hashem kulam b'chachma asiso. So, if chachma is the wisdom of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and Torah is the chachma elokis, it's the wisdom of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so then mitzad the wisdom, mitzad the chachma, what really is the difference? Why is it that goyim can and do have a shaykhis to Chochma, but they cannot have a shaykhis to Torah? When you delve into Chochma, if a person delves into mathematics, the sciences, and all the other Chochmois, you're pushed blown away. You're blown away. The Rambam even says that this is something that can mamish bring a person to Avas Hashem and Yiras Hashem. It's a wow. It's an incredible wow. But at a certain point, if the person learning Chachma is truly a Chacham, if he's truly a thinking person, he will ask himself, so what? Okay, there's an endless amount of wows available for discovery, but what is the point of it all? What is the purpose? That is the difference, I believe, between Chachma and Torah. Chachma can tell you nothing more than the what of this world. You can observe the world, the stars, the galaxies, molecules, atoms, quarks, mountains, oceans, fungi, human psyche. There's no dearth. There's kimat no end to it. You can do your tests, your experiments, your studies, and you can learn a lot, a whole lot. You can learn how things work, how to make things work, how to make things work better. It's the wow of the entire Bria. But all that is the what. It's the ma. Okay? So you've got a whole lot of what. But so what? After all is said and done, who cares? What is the point of it all? That is Torah. Ki heim chayenu v'erech yomenu. Leman leiniga larik v'leinelin lebohola. The Torah is the Ribbono shel Olam revealing to us, and only to us, the so what. What is the point of it all? Torah is what identifies for us the purpose of everything. The tachlis ma'ase breishis. What are we supposed to be doing in this wow of a universe? What is it, and what are we here for? What is it here for, and what are we here for? And that is why Chochmah, even though it too is from and belongs to the Ribbono shel Olam, is called Chol, or Chulin. Whereas the Torah is the Heilige Torah. It's the Torah HaKedusha. A Sefer Torah and all Sfarim of Divrei Torah have Kedusha. If you have a pile of money, for example, it has no intrinsically defined purpose. You could use it for whatever you choose. If you're makdish that money, if you infuse it with kedusha, what that means is that you are setting down, you are being kaveya, a deeply meaningful purpose for this money. Whether you're makdish the money for the bezek habayis or a karbon in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, or for tzedakah, or building a shul or a base medrash nowadays, the kedusha that you put into the money by being makdish, it means that you have taken the undefined potential of the money and you have designated it for a higher purpose, for something of meaning, for a goal that matters, that it carries significance and importance. So what we see then is that kedusha is purpose. Kedusha is meaningfulness. Kedusha is significance. It's value. When you identify and learn about and work towards the so what, that is Kedusha. So when we talk about the Torah's rules and values as they pertain to sexuality, as in Yoni Kedusha, what we mean is that we need to identify the purpose and the meaning of one of the most powerful Koiches HaGuf VeHaNefesh, perhaps the most powerful, and strive towards integrating that purpose and meaning into our life so that that purpose and meaning becomes its primary guiding force. The power of the sexual drive, the reproductive system, is enormous. It is the power of procreation through which, as Chazal say, man becomes a partner, and by man we mean mankind, human beings, men, women. Man becomes a partner, a shutef, with the Ribbono shel Olam himself. That happens primarily when we understand its purpose and how to use it in a way so that that purpose is properly fulfilled. That happens when we calibrate ourselves as best as we can to not misuse this tremendous power, to not abuse this tremendous power. Because what is abuse other than misuse? Now that finally brings us directly to the topic of this conference, which once again is, help, my son is growing up, what should I say? When our kids are very young, their issues are, generally speaking, relatively simple. This can be difficult for parents who do not yet have preteens or teenagers to believe, as it was difficult for me to believe when I was at that stage of life. But once that stage of life is realized and is reached, there's that Yiddish expression, kleine kinder, kleine tzores, Greise kinder, greise tzaris, can come to be felt very acutely. The really complex issues start to arise when kids reach the stage of beginning the shift towards adulthood. Small children, and really the entire parenting experience of dealing with small children, is to a great extent a bechina of being blissfully ignorant. It reminds me of something I was once told a bachur a number of years ago when he was in Shiduchim. Now, Baruch Hashem, he's married with children. He shared with me at that time his sense of frustration at navigating this complex chapter of life called Shiduchim. And he put it in a very cute way. The way he put it was like this. I remember life being so simple when I was a little kid. All you have to do is just daven really hard to Hashem that mommy should get another baby, and that's it. Ah, yes, the blissful ignorance of the childhood years, so sweet, so innocent, so untainted, but of course, so completely in the stage of pure potential. Because that's just it. Small children are pure potential. They have not actualized their potential. Attaining real goals, actually materializing the purpose for which we've been put into this world, means that we can no longer be blissfully ignorant. We have to struggle with real thorny problems. When our kids, and in this context of this conference, and in Mir Tzashem, the course that will follow in the coming weeks, we're focusing on the boys, when they begin to reach pre-puberty and puberty, when they begin to develop both physically and emotionally, and their sexuality starts to really come to the fore, then that's when all the thorny complexity begins to come to the fore. And when that happens, we parents often struggle with a number of very important questions. Questions that can really upset our own sense of equilibrium if we don't attend to those questions and provide ourselves with satisfying answers. And it's not as if the questions just disappear once we have, for example, a 16 or 17-year-old son who is already more or less fully developed. Sometimes the questions can get even more pointed. So what are those questions? Let's go through a list of what they can sound like, whether a person is consciously thinking them or just kind of subconsciously or semi-consciously struggling with them. So here's what some of them sound like. How is my son going to handle going through puberty? Should I talk to him about the changes that his body is going through? Should I prepare him for it in advance? Maybe it's better just to keep it quiet. After all, maybe if I talk to him about it, it will put thoughts in his head that he would not have had. Should I talk to my son about the attraction between boys and girls? Should I talk to my son about the Isurim of Hirhurim, Istaklus, and Zerah Levatala, sexual fantasizing, gazing for sexual pleasure and masturbation? Should I talk to him about those Isurim? Should I explain to my son how babies are born? And if yeah, so how much detail? With what language? How do I say it? Should I wait until I realize my son is already talking about these things with his friends and then talk to him about it? How would I even begin such a conversation? Should I sit him down and say, my son, mein Sohn, I need to have an important talk with you. Is that how to do it? If I'm going to have this talk with my son, how on earth is it not going to be incredibly awkward? So what's the bottom line of all these questions? Help! My son is growing up and I don't know if or what to say. So hence the title of this conference. So how about if we first address the question that goes like this. Maybe I shouldn't say anything at all. After all, I don't want to chas v'shalom put thoughts into his mind that he would have otherwise not had. I don't want to give him ideas of things that he might feel like trying out. So how about if we address that question first? So point number one. Already in 1982, Tav Shin Mem Beis, that is fully 41 years ago. Rav Shlomo Volba Zatzal, who was this Kan HaMashgichin, he wrote about the need for boys to get a proper chinuch in regards to the mitzvahs that pertain to the sexual drive. And here is how Rav Volba put it. We're only going to quote now a very small part of the paragraph where he talks about this in a paper that he wrote in 1982. And Emir Tushem, when we get to the actual course, we will speak about it much more in detail and mention everything. So Rav Volba writes like this, Hatkufa hakosha shel ha'izbagrus. The difficult, and I'm going to give my own free translation to this, the difficult period when a bachur matures, hikarka peira is fertile ground, legidul rigshei ashma, for the development of guilt complexes, ubifrat litzayir hadasi, especially for the frum teenager. Hey Namis, hachaim batoiro tzichim chinuch intensivi. It is absolutely true. Torah life, living a Torah life successfully demands intensive education and guidance. Bli chinuch ein manos mikach she'atzoyer yishka berigshei ashma v'yush. Without proper education, without proper guidance, there is no escaping the reality that a boy will simply get swallowed up by guilt feelings and a pervasive sense of utter hopelessness. That was written by Revolba in 1982, 41 years ago. Only 3 years after that article was written, only 3 years after Revolba wrote those words, in 1985, Rabbi Daniel Adenson, Shlita, happened to once mention in a conversation that he was having with the Novominska Rebbe Zatzal that Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky had said that children should be educated about sexual matters at the age of 16. The Novominska Rebbe looked at Rabbi Adenson and he said, without missing a beat, and please let us not forget that this conversation took place 38 years ago. It was a very different world. 38 years ago. The Novominska Rebbe said back to Rabbi Adenson, it is too late for children today to wait until 16. Even some 8-year-olds know more than I do. So said the Novominska Rebbe, as put down by Rabbi Daniel Adenson. This is written in his book. It is recorded. That is what the Novominska Rebbe said in 1985, fully 38 years ago. 16 is too late for children today. Even some 8-year-olds know more than I do. And that, let's not miss the point over here. The clear implication of what the Novominska Rebbe was saying is that A, it is not good for kids to learn about sexuality from outside sources. B, nowadays, kids, while they are still kids, are by and large going to learn about sexuality from somewhere because there is so much curiosity naturally about it. And there is simply so much information floating around about it. And that was even 38 years ago. What would we say? What do you think the Novominska Rebbe would say if he was here now? In Tavshin Pei Gimel. Now, point number three is, believe it or not, this concern of, oh yeah, maybe we're going to put thoughts into kids' minds and give them ideas, this concern is not exclusive to Frum Yin. There is a lot of research about the topic of what is called sex ed, sexual education for children in the Geisha Welt. And what comes out, if you read the articles and the papers, etc., is that many Goyim are, or at least were, because the world has changed enormously in the past 5-10 years regarding these inyanim, but it seems that even now, there are still many Goyim that have this concern. They also are worried about the same exact thing. How could I talk to my kids about sex ed? Aren't I going to be putting the wrong thoughts in their minds? Aren't I going to be giving them ideas of things that I don't want them to be doing? So what does the research say about that? Now, I want to make it clear. Once we have statements from G'dayli Yisrael, you don't need research. But I look at it as like a palpalin l'chachma. It's like a spice. You know, it helps us to taste it a little bit better, and it helps it to sit. So, Lamaisa, what does the research say about that? Is it true that if parents speak to their kids about the so-called birds and the bees, that the kids will then go ahead and try to act like the birds and the bees? So, it's like this. Although from what I could gather, it did not seem absolutely conclusive, overall, the research seems to strongly indicate that the answer is no. If anything, the research indicates that kids who are given sexual education wind up delaying getting involved in sexual behaviors. Meaning, if you compare a group of children, Goyisha children we're talking about right now, if you compare a group of Goyisha children whose parents never taught them sex ed, they never spoke to them about the so-called birds and the bees, and another group of children whose parents did, then you will find that overall the group of children whose parents did educate them about sexuality push off sexual activity for longer than the kids whose parents didn't speak to them. And in addition to that, the kids whose parents speak to them about sexuality, again, we're talking about the Geisha Welt over here, when they do wind up beginning to get involved in sexual activity, they do less risky stuff. They're more responsible about it. So the upshot of the research is, as far as we can tell, is that proper education empowers kids to be responsible about their sexuality. And I strongly believe, and I think this is a davar pashut, that we from Yidden have no reason to believe that that wouldn't be the case with our Yiddish kinderlach. Adarabah, I believe that by us it's a kal v'chomer. So, as far as we can tell from the research, teaching children, obviously in the appropriate manner, about sexuality is not going to give them ideas and make them wind up doing things. Adarabah, it will give them the tools and the empowerment that they need to be responsible about their sexuality, and responsible in the Yiddish oifen. Now, a very additional, important rabbinical statement made on this topic was made by the Baltimore Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Aaron Feldman Shlita, who, for those who may not be familiar, is one of the members of the Meyetzes G'dayli HaTorah of Agudas Yisrael of America. And this statement is not just Rav Aaron Feldman. There is an entire book written on the topic of how to educate your boys about sexuality. It's called From Boys to Men, by Dr. Shlomi Zimmerman. And this book has numerous haskamais, Rav Aaron Feldman, Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky, Rav Elie Brudny, Rav Simcha Bunim Kain. Now, in a previous pamphlet on this topic, on the very same topic, Rav Aaron Feldman specifically made a point in his haskama to emphasize that sexuality and the mitzvahs and the values of the Torah, these inyanim, should be taught to boys before they begin puberty. So holds Rav Aaron Feldman. And he explained, because once they've already begun puberty, then the taivas are already there very, very strongly. The urges are already there very, very strongly. And it can make it more difficult for them to hear it in a simple, straightforward, easygoing manner. If you teach it to them before they begin puberty, though, then they just hear the ideas as the ideas are in and of themselves, and it enables the ideas to sit right in their mind and not to be understood with too much undue influence by raging hormones. Now, my own Rebbe, Rav Aaron Lopiansky Shlita, made the following two points that further underscore and highlight and emphasize the need for educating boys about sexuality. Point number one, boys who don't learn about sexuality from their parents or from Rebbeim, they are going to hear about it from their friends. It's not a maybe. The way he put it down is that it's a vavay. They are going to hear about it from their friends. And that, as we saw from the comment of the Nova Minsk Rebbe, and as any common sense would anyway make plainly evident, is not something that we want to be happening. We don't want our children, and again, now we're specifically speaking about boys, we don't want our children to be learning about sexuality from their friends. We don't want our children to be learning about sexuality from the street. We don't want them learning about sexuality from outside Sitra de Achra sources. That's point number one. Point number two, when sexuality is addressed in a forthright, calm, confident manner, it takes the fangs out of it. But if you leave it taboo, silenced, stigmatized, then sexuality can become a sort of monstrous dragon, and that monstrous dragon has a tendency to materialize as a self-fulfilling prophecy. But when you do talk about it in the right oifen, you defang it. You make it a lot less scary. Now, here is a short story that highlights all these points. There is a boy who was in a certain cheder, and this father, I know this family quite well, actually. The father of this boy very, very much embraces the shita that we're espousing here. And he taught his son about sexuality through the Mishnais and the Gemaras that they learned together. When they would get to a Mishnah that touches on matters of sexuality, when they would get to a Gemara like that, the father used that as the opportunity to teach his son, which, by the way, is going to be the main bulk, Emir Tashem, of the actual course that will follow Emir Tashem in the coming weeks. So one day, about 2 or 3 years after this boy first learned about sexuality through the Torah that he learned with his father, this boy comes home one day from cheder, and he mentions that one of the boys in his class was told to go home. And eventually this boy wound up being expelled. Now, the classmate wound up being expelled. Now this boy, when he made this comment, it was like almost nonchalantly, like as a derech agav, you know, something that happened to happen today. But the boy's father questioned him and he said, "Really? Boy was sent home today? Your classmate was sent home? What happened?" And then eventually, you know, he was expelled. Why was he expelled? So his son said, well, my classmate had been talking to boys in the class about inappropriate things. Well, now the father was not only curious, but he was concerned. He wanted to know, you know, did this classmate speak to my son? And what did he tell him? Are there things that I have to straighten out? So the father says to his son, did he talk to you too? Well, the boy said, he tried, but not really. Oh, what exactly happened? Well, he came over to me and he said, do you know what tatis and mommies do in their bedrooms? And I understood what he wanted, so I just said, yes. He looks kind of disappointed, and he walked away from me and went on to the next boy in the class. The father was ecstatic. He was very happy to hear what his son had just told him. It was the best outcome that he could have hoped for. You see, there was no tantalizingly forbidden dirty talk for that classmate to discuss with this particular boy, because this boy already knew about sexuality from the Tzadak Kedusha. He already knew about it from his father. He already knew about it B'Tahara. He already knew about it from the Torah. And there was really nothing new for him to learn from this dirty-talking classmate. But it was more than that. From learning about sexuality in a completely pure and wholesome way from his father, who was teaching him Torah, this boy understood two things. And let's very clearly put down what these two things are. Number one, there is no sharp-fanged monster to get all excited about over here. Sexuality is a reality of existence, no different than any other aspect of our reality, and there is no reason to get all hyped up over your deep, dark secret, because there is no deep, dark secret. That is number one. Number two, this boy was already educated by his father that even though sexuality is a reality of our existence, no different from any other reality, it is different in that it is a matter of utmost kedusha. Just like a Sefer Torah. Think about it. It's kept wrapped up inside. You have to first walk into the shul, and then you have to go past the bima, and then there's a pareches, and then there's an aron kodesh, and then there's a mantle. The Torah is in a cover. Why? Because that is covered. Because a Sefer Torah is such an important and precious thing that if it would just be paraded out in the open, it would be a zilzal. It would be a disgrace. And so too is it with sexuality. This is based on a Gemara in Yuma. I'm not going to get into it now. It is so extremely important. Sexuality is so extremely significant and precious that it demands tremendous tzniyus. To talk about it in order to make sense of self, to make sense of the world, that is necessary. It's justified. A person needs to have an equilibrium. He can't live in confusion. And how much more so to talk about it within the context of understanding a Mishnah or understanding a Gemara or a Halacha, that's mamish limud haTorah. You can have no greater justification than that. But to stam talk about it? To indulge curiosity? Or worse? That is nothing less than a terrible disgrace. It's a tremendous disgrace of the Kedusha. So this boy was educated and thus immunized from the dirty talk of his classmate. He knew that sexuality is not a sharp, fanged, deep, dark, secret monster to get all hyped up about, and he also knew that sexuality is such a kadosh matter. It is a matter of such deep purpose and significance and meaning that it demands tznius, it demands kavod. You don't just go stam talking about it with friends. Now, a very important point to be cognizant of is that in addition to the inherent value of proper understanding, a primary goal in educating our boys about the Torah's guidelines on sexuality is to equip them with the wherewithal to survive their teenage years and emerge as healthy, emotionally balanced men. I want to elaborate on this point a little bit, so I'm going to bring a couple of Mar Mekaymis to elaborate on this point. There's a famous story of Rabbi Sol Salanter, the founder of the Musar movement, regarding the engagement of his granddaughter to a bacher who would one day become the Gadol Hador, Rav Chaim Eizer Grodzensky. The chassan, when he was a chassan at that time, he sent the great Zayde a letter in which he wrote amazing Gevaldike Chidushei Torah. But Rabbi Sol Salanter was not satisfied. He wrote his own letter to his daughter and son-in-law, And he said as follows. Look, I see that the chassan that you chose for my granddaughter is a great Talmud Chacham, and I had no suffix that you would only choose a great Talmud Chacham for your daughter. But when the Torah talks about marrying off your daughter, the expression that the Torah uses is Ezbiti Nasati Lo Ish Hazeh. You have to give your daughter to an Ish, to a man, to a mensch. And about the Ish, I still know nothing. This is an extremely revealing statement. What it shows you is that until you build a mensch, you really have nothing. And it shows you that it's possible for someone to be a Talmud Chacham, Kenzain even a big Talmud Chacham, and still it's possible for him to be lacking in the most basic way. The Aleph Beis is to build a mensch. And the mensch is his midas. And the midas are obviously going to be profoundly influenced by the health and the balance of his mental and emotional makeup. We find a similar idea in the Rambam in Hilchos Deis, where the Rambam says, you want to know why it's so important to exercise and eat properly and sleep properly and take care of your body so that it should be healthy? Because illness is a disruptor from Avodas Hashem. A person can't engage in Avodas Hashem when he's ill the same way that if he's healthy. Now, obviously, if a person is ill, and it's a nisayin from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that is a certain type of Avodas Hashem that only someone in that situation can do it. But as a general rule, the Rambam is putting down, which is poshit, is that we are meant to be healthy so that we can do Avodas Hashem properly. And that's why we have to do our best to keep the physical body as healthy as possible. It's a basic prerequisite to properly engaging in Avodas Hashem. Now, to really bring home the point that I'm trying to make, a very, very unfortunate example of what we're talking about is the fact that there are so many people nowadays who suffer from severe mental illness or addictions, and I'm not claiming right now, I want to make something clear, I am not trying to claim right now that lack of education about sexuality is the cause of all the severe mental illness or addictions. I'm mentioning this in order to demonstrate and show how basic mental and emotional health is to life in general and specifically to the life of a yid. So there's so many people that are suffering from severe mental illness or addictions that there are rabbanim who have felt it necessary to be videoed publicly and that these videos should be publicly published, that they said that sometimes in these types of situations, and I don't want to get into the halacha lemaisa aspects, every single person has to ask their rav, that sometimes there are situations where people in these matzavim, they have no choice. They have to be machal Shabbos, whether it's to call their therapist or attend a support group on Zoom or whatever it is. And I think the way one of the rabbanim who was videoed, the way he put it was, forget about Shabbos, forget about Yontif, it's pikuach nefesh, it's doiche. And these things can reach the level, rachmanu litzlan, of pikuach nefesh. Now, again, obviously, a person who is suffering from mental illness or is struggling with addiction or whatever, and needs to call his therapist on Shabbos or something like that because it's pikuach nefesh, obviously that person is not doing anything wrong. Adarabu, on the contrary, he's doing what the halacha says you have to do. But oy va'avoy, a million times over, if a parent were to say, no, so my child will come out being mentally ill and never be able to keep Shabbos in a normal way. No, pikuach nefesh is deicha Shabbos, so it's not nevera. Obviously, if a person would think like that, then he himself would be suffering from some terrible personality disorder. Obviously, our job is to try our best to raise our kinderlach, that they will be healthy in body and in spirit and be able to live a proper Torah life the way it was meant to be lived. So yes, as we said, the Aleph Beis of building a person is doing your best to cultivate an Ish, a mensch who is healthy in body and spirit. Trying to build someone into an Ovid Hashem without that, it would be like trying to write Chidushei Torah on non-existent paper. So that is why when we talk about educating our boys about sexuality, the focus, in my opinion, and this is what I believe comes forward very clearly from the words of Ravolba and others, the focus should not be on any specific mitzvah or avero. Rather, the focus needs to be on the fact that sexuality is a massive koyach, and right now I'm talking about our focus, not the focus when we're talking to our sons. Right now, I'm just talking about what we understand going into it. We need to understand and focus on the fact that sexuality is a massive koyach. It may very well be the most powerful koyach that there is. And in the absence, if there's no guidance and education and support, then all of the incredibly powerful pulls and twists and swirls and maelstroms and waves and currents and undercurrents, tornadoes, whirlpools, earthquakes, and volcanic eruptions that can come along with sexuality and its intersection with living a Torah life can knock a boy off course. It can pulverize him into powder. It can drown him, burn him, and destroy him in any number of ways. Yes, this sounds melodramatic. And to a certain extent, maybe I am over-dramatizing it. And it would seem, at least b'hashkafa rishayna, that most people have enough inborn resilience to weather the storms, even without guidance and support, and are able to come out more or less okay. But, as Rav Volba said, the adolescent years are years that are fertile ground for the development of crushing guilt complexes and pervasive hopelessness. So there will definitely be at least some boys that will get crushed in the absence of appropriate guidance and support. And what parent wants to take a gamble like that on his son's life? Furthermore, and I'm about to say something that might be a bit, or maybe even a bit more than a bit, controversial, and maybe I'm exaggerating in what I'm about to say, but I do think it needs to be said. So I beg your indulgence. And I apologize in advance if this is upsetting to some people, but I feel that it's an important point that needs to be spoken out. Even if it's not completely true, I believe that there's enough truth in what I'm about to say that it needs to be spoken out. Why is it that in so many shuls, it seems like there are many people, and by people I mean specifically men, I don't daven in the Ezes Nashim when there's women there, why is it that so many people seem so disconnected? Why do people often seem to be more interested in staring into space than concentrating on the words of davening? Now, maybe there is more than one possible cause to this phenomenon, but it seems to me that one of the causes might be precisely what we are talking about here. You see, in the absence of proper education regarding sexuality, as Rav Volba put it, a boy is prone to being crushed by guilt and hopelessness. A boy can be assailed by a feeling of being burdened with the impossible, that the Torah expects of him, even demands of him at the threat of terrible consequences, to control his sexuality in a way and to an extent that he feels is just not possible. If you just leave a bacher to his own devices, and he comes across the Torah sources, and make no mistake, he will definitely come across those sources that seem to tell him, you may never ever have sexual fantasies. You may never ever sexually gaze at girls, and you may never, ever, 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 ever masturbate. That bacher might very understandably feel, this is beyond impossible. I'm nichshol in these things all the time, or sometimes. And if you give someone an impossible task, and that's what the bacher is thinking to himself, this is impossible, I'm nichshol in these things. Like, well, what do you mean never? What do you mean I can't do these things? If you give someone an impossible task, something that they truly cannot fulfill under any circumstances. Okay, imagine that you have a slave or a worker, and you give them a task that is actually impossible for them. It is poshit, not shaykh, for them to do it. Then don't you think that that person is going to conclude that you are simply out to get him? Why are you putting on me a burden that I cannot bear? If a boy feels that the same HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who created him with this incredibly powerful koyach called the sexual drive, is the same HaKadosh Baruch Hu who is imposing upon him an absolutely impossible burden of absolute control of that impossibly powerful drive, if that's what the boy is feeling and thinking, then how can that boy not come to the conclusion that Hashem is out to get him, chas v'shalom? Of course, there is almost no deeper apikarsis than such a thought, that God is out to get you? That would mean that he is some sort of sadistic being who revels at the opportunity to trip people up, cause them to sin, and toss them into the pits of hell. Can there be any greater apikarsis than that? To think of the Ribbono Shel Olam in such a way? Now, maybe there are some religions out there that have this type of outlook on God. Who knows? But our Torah teaches us that the Ribbono Shel Olam is a Tovu Meitiv. He's never out to get us. Ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu Ba B'Trunya Im B'riyosov. Hashem is never looking to trip us up and make things impossible for us. But what can happen if someone has this feeling that something or someone is out to get him? Perhaps for most people, it's too scary a thought to face. You know, because facing such a thought would mean entertaining the idea that he's an apikaris, because you automatically realize, yeah, that's apikaris to think about the Ribbono Shel Olam as someone out to get you. And if he's an apikaris, well, then he's got no chelik in Olam Haba. And if he has no chelik in Olam Haba, then he may as well be dead right now, because there's no worse death than ein lechelik l'Olam Haba. So the survival mechanism that is so strongly ingrained into the human brain may cause it that the feeling of something is out to get me gets repressed, pushed down, down, down into the unconscious or maybe semi-conscious depths of the psyche. But the feelings are be'etzim still there. And it can cause an incredibly deep chasm of distance from Hashem, from Yiddishkeit, a tremendous disconnect. Now, in Limud HaTorah and many, many mitzvahs, a yid can get swept up into the details, the ritualistic technicalities, the sheer intellectual delight. But by tefillah, by davening, there's no way out. The entire cheftza of tefillah, the entire totality and reality of tefillah is nothing other than directly connecting with the Ribbono Shel Olam, engaging in a relationship with him. So maybe that is why it is specifically regarding tefillah that we seem to see so much disconnect, even amongst people that are otherwise very connected. We seem to see a disinterest, a listlessness, an almost pathetic, desperate attempt to find anything, anything other than the tefillah to catch our attention. Now, I want to push back, so to speak, on my own words over here. I believe that it speaks to the incredible godless of a yid, that even though he may have that nebuch mistaken feeling deep down inside him that Hashem is chalila out to get him, he nevertheless pushes himself very hard to discharge his obligations, because he knows with his seichel that it's not true. He has that feeling, Kenzine, somewhere deep down, but he knows that it's not true, and he tries very hard to discharge his obligations. And during Shemoneh Esrei itself, he makes a great effort to maintain kavana. But is that the way it's meant to be? That the moment he takes his three steps back, or the moment he hears the tkiyas after Ne'ilah on Yom Kippur, that he should feel a gigantic sense of relief of, oh, phew, Baruch Hashem, it's over. Is that what we hope that a yid will grow up to be? Phew, that it's over. We can do better than that. And we absolutely need to do better than that. Again, I will agree that A, perhaps I am somewhat dramatizing things, and B, kavana in tefillah is inherently a very difficult thing, and there can be more causes to this issue than what I've described, but A, I do believe that what I've described does play at least some not insignificant part in the apparent tefillah disconnect phenomenon, and B, at least one person with whom I shared this thought admitted to me that what I described to him is exactly how he had felt for a long time, but never really realized it. So the bottom line is that maybe, just maybe, the assertion that most people are resilient enough to come out more or less okay, even without proper guidance and education about sexuality, maybe, just maybe, that assertion is not necessarily true. So yes, our job is to provide our boys, and please don't be worried, I know it's already midnight where some of most people are attending this conference, and I plan to wrap up in a couple of minutes. I did not manage to get through everything that I needed to say in the conference, so Imir Tashem, next time, next week, same day, same time, Imir Tashem, there will be another free conference. And I'll mention questions in just a minute, but before I get to that, I just want to wrap up. So yes, our job is to provide our boys with both the information as well as the emotional support that they need to develop a confident understanding of the place of sexuality in the life of a person, in the life of a Torah Yid. There needs to be a sense of, yeah, I get it. It makes sense. It feels right. Is it easy? No, definitely not. But then again, is any significant human endeavor easy? No, not really. But it makes sense to me. I get how it all fits in. That's what we need to achieve when we are mechanich, our boys, about sexuality. And in order to do that, things need to be understood and taken in their appropriate proportions, which is one of the big points that we will, Amir Tashem, be elaborating upon during the actual course in the coming weeks. So I am going to wrap up now, and I'll just mention again that next time there will be another free conference. I don't know if it'll be a full hour long, but there will be another free conference to conclude the material of the free conference. And in addition, since it was muted, per the guidance of Das Torah, this conference was muted so that nobody was able to ask questions. If anybody has questions, so even though we're not done, but it's fine, you can either email me at rbsa613@gmail.com. For those who might not know, RBSA stands for Ramat Beit Shemesh Aleph, where I live. So it's rbsa613@gmail.com. That is my email. That's definitely the best way to get through to me. Alternatively, you can use the Oil Miriam system to leave me a voice message. It will funnel the voice messages to my email. And what I will do is that in Emirat Hashem, next time I will address whatever questions can be addressed within the context of the free conference. I will address those questions as well next time. And I would like to end off by saying that sexuality, taka, is a very sensitive topic. It's a topic that can be difficult to address even for oneself, let alone one's child. And I therefore salute and applaud all of you for joining in for this conference. And I do look forward to continuing this journey with you during the upcoming second free conference and Emirat Hashem, the course that will follow in the coming weeks. Yashar Koyach.